Okay, we are back once again with Legal Perspectives on Athletics, and our resident expert in this area is Justin Sievert, partner at Sievert Worley, and we're going to be talking about a number of things through the course of this winter and spring semester. Last fall, we started talking about things related to NCAA compliance, NCAA enforcement issues, Title IX, and a lot of that area of the legal aspects of college athletics, but we're shifting to talk about more of the business operations aspects now, and I'm looking forward to the variety of topics we're going to cover in the weeks ahead. But Justin, thanks for being here. Why don't you go ahead and say hi and remind us a little bit about you and your background?
Yeah, so thanks for having me back, Mark. We must have done some okay work to be able to keep going this semester. So I am a attorney. I've been working in college athletics and with colleges and universities and conferences for the past 10 years. A lot of the work we do in the college athletics field relates to a lot of the topics we've talked about. We represent institutions that are involved in the NCAA enforcement process. We help schools with regulatory issues such as NCAA compliance and Title IX. And then we also work with a number of institutions on helping them with some of their business affairs, and that's kind of going to be our focus this semester. And that can be anything ranging from helping out with a coaching contract, a sponsorship agreement, having a facility that you want to rent out, or anything of that nature. So we work with colleges and universities on a variety of issues affecting their athletics department, and we enjoy doing so.
Yeah, and I think it's important to also note, while you do work with colleges and universities at all levels, including Division I schools, you've also have experience working with smaller colleges as well, and often that's the case where on smaller campuses, they may not have their own general counsel or have a firm on retainer, and you kind of specialize in that area as well, and you do that good work there. So I think I'm excited about what we're going to talk about this spring, because they are some very real aspects of the job that, again, for a lot of small colleges and small college athletic departments, may not be thinking too much about the importance of some of these things we're going to cover. And today we're starting off with a topic related to sponsorships and how you can effectively put together good sponsorship agreements that are serving you and the sponsor well, but also protecting one another as well. And there's a lot of things that go into that, but that's what we're going to be talking about today. So what is that? Why don't you give us the overview here?
Yeah, so a lot of institutions, especially at the Division II and III level, are new to using sponsorship agreements for athletics. And that can be anything from, you know, having a sponsor put their logo on your website for a certain amount of money in a certain duration. That can be having a sponsor put their logo or using a booth like for at a facility and for one of your athletics events, or any number of means. They can sponsor a specific, you know, event itself, like a track meet or anything of that nature. There's, you know, numerous opportunities to create arrangements where a sponsor can have their brand represented on your campus, and you can receive some type of compensation for having them do that. So, you know, it's really important when you're doing that, before we even get into more of the specifics, is to really understand, you know, who your potential sponsor is and what their expectations are, because really the underlying cause of the issues we see with everything we're going to talk about is just each side really failing to understand the business realities of the other side. So it's really important to understand that before you really look to go into any type of deal.
Right. And as you said, there's just this increasing pressure for small college athletic departments to be able to generate more revenue, to be able to do more things with less, and the opportunity to bring in external revenue from sponsorship agreements is a place where more and more people are headed. And we're going to dive into some of these things that I think jump out as things to pay attention to. And one is exclusivity. Sometimes it might be nice to be able to work with just one sponsor in a particular area, whether it's a car dealership or whatever. But more likely, it's a shotgun approach where you're out there, you're talking to many businesses, trying to get as many businesses on board as possible to maximize your revenue. But are there legal implications of working with multiple sponsors at a time? And what should people be thinking about?
Yeah, so when you look at exclusivity, I think, you know, with most small colleges and universities and athletics, you know, there really is a limited number of opportunities to create what is, you know, a really meaningful sponsors of engagement, and any sponsor, and rightfully so, they're going to want to have as much inventory as you're willing to provide them for, you know, the smallest possible dent in their budget. So one of the things as a part of that is that a sponsor will really want to secure is category exclusivity. They're really going to want to be the sole sponsor for your athletics, you know, events or website, you know, related to what they actually do. So, you know, for example, maybe your school has some type of local clothing company that's pretty popular locally, maybe not quite as popular nationally, and you're looking to arrange some sort of agreement with them, and so you're having your negotiation on what your school can provide them, and maybe their vision is they want a logo on your website, they want their logo on various athletics facilities, they want to, you know, have their brand in your bookstore, and they want to be able to have all those things as part of their sponsorship agreement. But maybe when you see what they have to offer in terms of money or compensation, you know, you think that that's probably worth having the logo on your website and maybe allowing them to set up some type of booth at certain athletics events. But, you know, you have concerns because you already have agreements in place with other apparel providers for your teams that are bigger vendors like Nike or Adidas or something like that. So when you have this type of, you know, discussion with that sponsor, you're going to see that, you know, each of you has a different vision on what the rights should be. And this is ultimately where you see a lot of disputes arise, because the nature of this relationship isn't really negotiated or written appropriately. It's more of, you know, here's what we're going to do, and here's the money we're going to provide. And it goes from there, and it's not really written out well, where each side really understands the agreement because you both think it means something different. And with that, what happens is, you know, it's going to either result in litigation at worst, where you're going to see potential damages and litigation costs and probably losing that sponsor, or at best, you're going to have an angry and disappointed partner. So it's really important when you're going through these things to make sure that everything is written out in specific details. And although this can really create some type of some uneasy discussions up front, it's really going to help avoid disputes in the long run. And I think the other benefit is it really helps you as an athletics department understand, you know, how you tier sponsorship deals. And it really makes you better prepared to explain your price points and the benefits involved in different tiers. So I think it helps you, you know, with your other sponsorships as well.
Right. Well, I think one of the challenges is for people new to this or creating a program on their campus from scratch or for the first time is that it's difficult to value the various things that you have for sponsorship opportunities. And at times, maybe you want to just get something started and you might take a small amount of money for something that later on down the road, as you get more sophisticated in your sponsorship sales, you realize you undervalued initially. And these agreements eventually will come up for renewal, and maybe there's an opportunity where you're trying to grow your sponsorships. But the whole idea of a contract and renewing this, and what should we be aware about in this area, especially if there's potential that you've got other sponsors that are willing to pay more, but you've had a longstanding relationship, and what can you say about that aspect?
Yeah, so most sponsorship agreements you see that are formalized in a written contract are going to have some type of provision that's going to discuss what and how the contract will renew. The issue there is most of these provisions with sponsorships aren't really written in a way where it allows each side to remain open to the possibilities of the market changing. So when you look at renewal options, usually you see, you know, with sponsorship agreements, three different types. You see just a general renewal. You see where the sponsor will have the right of first negotiation, and then you see where the sponsor will have the right of first refusal. With a general renewal, what you're really looking at is that once the agreement is up, the sponsorship agreement will renew with the same terms and conditions as set forth in the current deal, unless one of the parties opts out in a certain amount of time. The problem with this is that the renewal provision fails to really define and account for the changes, you know, that would happen, you know, with the deal. You know, maybe your athletics department is more successful and as a result has increased attendance at games and provides them with more, provides yourself with more bargaining power. Maybe there's a new facility on campus with which provides more signage opportunities. The renewal provision probably isn't going to take those things into account. So if you do have any sort of renewal feature, it's really important to have those, have some leeway where you can utilize, you know, your increased bargaining power to your advantage. If there's not a general renewal feature and you have a right of first negotiation, what this really means is that your sponsor is going to have the right to negotiate, you know, after, you know, you would make any type of, before you'd come to a deal with a new sponsor. This provides, you know, an institution with a good amount of leverage because it allows them, you know, to make the best deal possible. But the problem with it is that a lot of times when you see these right of first negotiation windows written into a contract, is they're written in a manner where it allows you to, as an institution, to have a really short negotiation window for the new sponsor. And so if you end up not working with the old sponsor again, the window to secure a new sponsor may be too small and can put you at a disadvantage when you're trying to negotiate with a new sponsor. The last type of renewal feature, as I noted, that you see is a right of first refusal. And what that really is if you're negotiating with a new sponsor, it allows the old sponsor to essentially, you know, have the right to meet whatever, you know, package that would be agreed to with the new sponsor. The issue there is that when you go to a new sponsor and you go through all the negotiations and you come to an agreement, if they know up front that deal is going to be able to be, you know, matched by your current sponsor, that kind of puts them into a position where they may not want to really work with you because it can be a lot of time and energy spent on their end for something that may ultimately not come into fruition. So when you're looking at renewal options, whether it's a general renewal, a right of first negotiation, or right of first refusal, it's really important to be clear about when a deal begins, when it ends, and what the specific details are in the renewal process. When you're going through these scenarios, it's really important to think through how your bargaining power could get bigger, could get stronger, or how it could go down. So you really make sure you're well prepared in the future to have a renewal option to your advantage. Another option before, you know, we move to the next topic is with renewals. If you have a long-term, like a multi-year partnership deal, one option is to have some type of break clause. And what a break clause would do is would allow either party the opportunity to terminate the agreement without cause at some sort of defined time. This is something that could be to your advantage if your sponsor partner really wants a long-term deal, but you have concerns about maybe having the deal go too long, but you really want to secure them, is trying to write in a break clause, because that would allow you an out without, you know, potentially getting yourself into a situation you don't want to be in.
Right, right. And I think that's really good information and a lot to take in and understand that most people aren't aware of. And that transitions us to another topic, which is really getting out of an agreement or termination of an existing agreement. And that could be for a variety of reasons. Either the sponsorship is not working out, or it's not valued properly, or perhaps the institution has concerns with a particular type of sponsor that you have brought on board, or maybe things generally just went sour for whatever reason, but you have this agreement in place. How do you get out of a situation like that if you need to?
Yeah, so I think one of the big issues for athletics departments is really making sure that you retain sponsors that are in line with the institution's mission. You know, as a higher education institution, I think everybody has concerns about the institution's brand, and you don't want to be associated with another business or vendor that could negatively affect your brand, because that could obviously affect, you know, enrollment or other areas that are vital to an institution's health. So when you look at, you know, termination provisions in a sponsorship agreement, the issue that I usually see is that they're really given little attention, and they're kind of written up in the same fashion for whatever type of contract you're dealing with. and not really specific to how a sponsorship contract should work. And this is really important because if you don't really define what is a material or immaterial breach of the sponsorship agreement, then you can really run into some situations you don't want to be in. So, for example, you know, would a dramatic change in the reputation of the business or the institution be a material breach? For example, if the institution has maybe a Title IX lawsuit, or they're involved in a lawsuit involving something like, you know, a Title VII or racially discriminatory hiring practices, would the sponsor want to be involved with the institution and sponsor their athletics, you know, in some fashion? Maybe not. Would that be a material breach? It depends what's in the contract. If you're the institution, maybe you're working with a sponsor, and that sponsor company is a local restaurant, and maybe that restaurant's caught serving, you know, underage people, you know, alcohol, underage minors, alcohol, or maybe the owner of that restaurant is arrested for some type of crime like sexual assault. You might not want to be associated with that restaurant or that owner anymore, and you would want to have an out. But are those actions material breaches, and what do they allow you to terminate? If those aren't written into the agreement, you know, what is and is not a material breach, you might be forced to go through the life of that agreement, even though it might, you know, adversely, you know, affect your institution in other areas. So it's really important to carefully think about, you know, potential scenarios that you may deal with if one of the sides runs into some type of trouble, and to really make sure that, you know, your termination provisions, you know, yield the results that you want should any of these types of scenarios actually arise.
You know, I think this is so helpful and so fascinating because I'm sure that many ADs are out there, like I was as an AD. I had some awareness and some sense that we should formalize these agreements and put something in writing, but we did it with our layperson's knowledge about how we should structure these written agreements. And as I think back in my past, I probably put together some agreements that were just lucky nothing bad went wrong, because there is all sorts of potential for that to happen because of the limited knowledge we were operating with. But also, on the other hand, a lot of smaller places or a small community perhaps have operated for a long time with simple handshake agreements about what you're going to do. And I wonder how you'd respond to this, because it almost seems, well, I guess what's your answer to this question? Is having no formal written agreement better than having a bad written agreement?
I don't think one is necessarily better or worse than the other, because yeah. You're going to run into anytime there's a dispute over the agreement. I mean, depending on what's actually in the agreement, you could be worse off having that agreement at all. But then again, if it's a verbal agreement, then you're really talking about, you know, using a lot of, you know, anecdotal information to try to figure out what the intent of the parties was. But the reality is that either way, you're probably going to end up spending a lot more money on the back end and for litigation than you may have on the front end, making sure that it was written in an appropriate right. manner. And that's right. not to say that, you know, obviously when you look at small college universities, not all those colleges and universities have an in-house counsel. And a lot of times if they do, they don't have the time to look over every single contract the institution's going to get in with any type of vendor or service provider. So you're still, you know, operating somewhat blind. So I think it's really important to understand that even if you want to do some of the front end legwork up front, while you're in the AD's chair, if the AD wants to take the initial crack at drafting a deal, then that's something that an attorney can come in on the back end and try to maybe do a quick review of it and look for any of the major, major pressing issues that they see. Or it can be a situation where maybe you have an attorney come in up front, draft a pretty standard boilerplate agreement that would apply to most things in your athletic department, mm-hmm. and then allow them to either tweak it if it's necessary, or have somebody in athletics be able to tweak it if necessary as well. Those are some other ways where you can try to save some money if that's necessary. It's important to note that, you know, an attorney should always be willing to be flexible and work with, you know, the resources you have. That may not be, you know, everything you want done, but it should at least provide you a better, you know, starting point than you would have been without any help, whether that's an internal counsel or if you're hiring out.
Right. Well, it seems like in any case, there is an important element here, which is just to get somebody with the knowledge and expertise to be involved at some level to help protect yourself, because there's too many potential things that could go wrong in any of these situations. So it sounds like it's worthwhile to explore the options to get some expertise.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, Justin, we've come to the end of our time for this first segment here, but I think, as usual, this has been great, very relevant information for people sitting in that 80s chair and thinking about things that perhaps they don't always think about. And I want to thank you again for joining us.
Absolutely. I look forward to being back next week.
Well, we will be back with some more information, and we look forward to sharing that with you on our upcoming episodes of Legal Perspective on Athletics.